I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current.
The haul is impressive, and it's setting the year to be a record-breaking one. The demand for drugs in the U.S. is strong, and the available resources being dedicated to fight it is growing.
In 2017, the U.S. Coast Guard set a record for the amount of drugs seized at sea, nearly 223 tons of cocaine. For decades, American military and law enforcement have been pushing further into international waters in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean, sometimes thousands of kilometers from the U.S., looking for boats carrying drugs and detaining suspected smugglers on board. Even if there's no evidence, they're bound for the United States. To that end, in recent years, the Americans have enlisted numerous allies, including Canada, to help. In November, the New York Times Magazine published a striking expose that raised serious questions about the conditions under which these suspected smugglers are detained on Coast Guard cutters. The article was headlined, "The Coast Guard's Floating Guantanamos." Now, the author of that story, Seth Freed Wessler, a New York-based journalist with the Investigative Fund, has teamed up with The Current's Kristen Nelson to investigate what role Canada plays in intercepting drug smugglers at sea. Here is their documentary, The Catch.
Right now at 5:30, the Coast Guard today showing off tons of illegal drugs that were seized at sea.
6 years ago, the U.S. government launched a campaign called Operation Martillo, Spanish for hammer. It was the latest iteration of the war on drugs, and it meant pushing further and further into international waters.
People are really appreciating the work that you're doing on stopping drugs from pouring into this country, and we are behind you all the way.
Under Martillo, the United States has made agreements with more than a dozen countries to expand this counter-narcotics effort. These countries share law enforcement intelligence, allow the use of their ports, or provide ships and airplanes.
The crew of the Coast Guard cutter Laguerre worked alongside the Canadian Navy in an operation in the waters off Mexico, Central and South America.
Since 2010, as part of a program called Operation Caribe, Canada has allowed U.S. Coast Guard teams to ride on Canadian vessels.
And this was no small find. We're talking about 36,000 pounds of pure cocaine.
After every deployment, the drugs are delivered to land. Often, U.S. Coast Guard crews line up for photo ops, and the narrative, celebratory.
In all, 17 drug smuggling vessels were stopped and 11 smugglers were detained.
But what the reports tend to leave out are who these people are, these alleged drug smugglers, and how they're being treated in international waters.
In November, I wrote a report for the New York Times Magazine exposing alleged mistreatment of suspected smugglers detained on Coast Guard cutters. Detainees were held for weeks on board ships, sometimes for months. Two dozen men described being shackled all day by their ankles to the decks of ships. In letters from prison, some detail what they experienced.
They wrote in Spanish, and these are actors voicing their words in translation.
We were chained to the floor and exposed to the sun, rain, and seawater. We couldn't sleep because we were cold.
They slept on the deck floor or on hard rubber mats.
And with each passing day, our worries grew because we didn't know what would happen to us.
Many say they were fed only small portions of rice and beans. Some lost 5, 10, even 15 kilos.
We felt scared and desperate, waiting for them to drop us off on shore.
They weren't told where they were being taken, nor allowed to contact their families or consulates.
Unable to ask anyone for help to get us out of that hell.
Given Canada's cooperation with the U.S. Coast Guard, these stories raise some serious questions. Were Canadian officials aware of these allegations? And if so, what's the significance of that?
We began to call through U.S. federal court cases for evidence of Canadian involvement. In the troves of these records, we identified 38 alleged or convicted smugglers locked up in the U.S. whose court papers mention a Canadian ship being involved in their interception.
We wrote dozens of these men asking what happened to them and what role Canadians played. Seven of them replied with letters or calls from prison.
Continue on West Woodland Ridge Drive for 3/4 of a mile.
Seth and I are driving through northwestern Florida on our way to meet a man who pleaded guilty to smuggling cocaine and who's now waiting to be sentenced.
Passing Cowfield, and here is the beginning of this county jail. The Coast Guard has been seizing drugs in the high seas for decades. But starting in 2012, the United States switched gears. Instead of returning most suspected smugglers to Latin America, they kept the majority of them on board, often for weeks, in order to deliver them to the United States for prosecution, almost all of them to Florida.
We're about 45 minutes early. I wonder if we should, I think we should go in like 20 minutes early.
Oscar Manuel Alvia Anchundia was picked up in October 2017.
We know that when his smuggling vessel was first intercepted in the Pacific, a Canadian ship was involved.
We can't bring a recorder into the jail, but we do meet with Alvia for several hours, sitting on small metal stools separated by a thick pane of glass in the prison visitation room.
Alvia is short and stocky, with closely cropped dark hair and a thin mustache. He's wearing an oversized prison jumpsuit with the word inmate on the back.
He's from Ecuador, and he tells his story, one he repeats again a few days later when he calls from the jail. He says he's a fisherman.
Sometimes you make some money with fishing, sometimes you make nothing, and you have meat. You go hungry because of that sometimes, and that is why I made the mistake.
Alvia is from the small village of Anconcito on Ecuador's southern coast. He says he's been fishing since he was about 11 years old, never went to school, can't read or write, and has always been poor. And he says he was worried he wouldn't be able to support his wife and their three children.
One day last October, after a night of fishing, he says a stranger approached him.
This guy is asking around which of us fishermen would be interested in a side job. I was desperate because I needed money. He said it was to take a trip. Una vuelta, as Ecuadorians call it.
He told him it would be easy. For $2,500 up front and more cash upon delivery, Alvia and two other recruits would smuggle cocaine in a small speedboat from Ecuador to a designated coordinate point off Central America. Alvia barely thought twice before accepting.
They traveled more than 2,000 kilometers north before arriving at the drop-off point.
They waited for a boat to hand off the drugs.
We called out to them and we heard some sounds. We heard and we thought they were the people who were to receive us. And we started to make signs with our lanterns, flashing our flashlights.
The night sky was dark, the wind was strong, and the sea choppy. A blinding light illuminated their boat. Alvia realized the approaching vessel was not the other smuggling boat. It was law enforcement. A Canadian naval vessel was on a counter-narcotics patrol nearby. American officials contacted it to intercept the speedboat.
Yes, we stayed on our boat from 2 a.m. until 9. It was raining, we were wet in our little boat.
Alvia couldn't see anything. He could only hear the motor of a boat approaching. And he heard voices, commands not to move. Then, officers boarded the smuggling boat and discovered cocaine. The Coast Guard says 478 kilos of it.
Several hours later, a storm was rolling in. The officers ordered the three men into a small Canadian patrol boat. They were then delivered to a 55-meter vessel, Her Majesty's Canadian ship Nanaimo. Alvia says conditions were quite good on the Canadian vessel.
They took us into their ship. We remained there for only one day. They treated us well. They let us walk around. They gave us good food. They gave us some coveralls so we couldn't get wet.
Though it was a Canadian ship, the team detaining Alvia was American. As part of Operation Carib, U.S. Coast Guard law enforcement teams, groups of about 8 or 10 officials, ride aboard Canadian ships.
Officially, Alvia was an American detainee. A day later, an officer ordered Alvia and the others back onto the patrol boat. In the distance, he could see another large military ship. They sped toward it. It was a U.S. Coast Guard cutter, a 64-meter-long ship called the Vigorous.
After he was loaded onto that vessel, Alvia says things took a sharp turn for the worse.
They put cuffs on us, chained us up. Our fear was to remain chained up.
Court documents show that he was held at sea for 17 days. He recalls being chained to pegs and cables on the decks of three Coast Guard cutters. On two of these boats, he and other suspects, picked up by the Coast Guard, slept outside, shackled by their ankles to a cable.
When it rained, we were all soaked up. Do you understand?
Alvia told us that on the Coast Guard vessels, the bathroom was just a plastic bucket and a hose to wash it out. No one told him where he was going, nor was he allowed to contact his consulate, a lawyer, or his family.
Our fear was that all of us would die.
And Oscar Alvia's story is not unique.
We've heard from seven men who report experiencing similarly abusive conditions on U.S. Coast Guard boats after they were stopped in international waters with the help of Canadian forces.
We were taken aboard an American Coast Guard vessel and placed in a gangway on deck and shackled to each other by the feet.
This is a translation of a letter we received from a 61-year-old man from Cartagena, Colombia. Alfredo Herrera Villarreal was chained on the decks of a series of American cutters in 2015.
There on the deck, we were exposed to rain, sun, fog for over 40 days.
The 40 days that he and seven others were shackled on board constituted the longest maritime detention of all the cases we found involving Canadian ships. And the conditions they experienced when they were on the U.S. Coast Guard cutters are consistent with other reports.
When we defecated, we had to do it on top of other feces. Every 2 or 3 days, the buckets were dumped out in the sea. It was simply inhumane. Even a phone call to our families was denied. To this day, I have nightmares because of the experience I went through on those boats.
Hoover Porto Querero and Willentong Ramirez, both Colombians, were captured together in 2017 in the Pacific by a U.S. Coast Guard team riding on a Canadian Navy ship.
The men say they remained on their smuggling boat for 2 days as they were towed by the Canadian ship.
We asked them why they didn't take us with them to the big ship, as the sun was scorching and the nights were freezing. But they say they are Canadians and they didn't have the authority to do that.
They waited until a U.S. boat called the Mohawk arrived and they were loaded on board.
We were placed, the three of us, right on the deck of the ship in open air. There was a tropical storm. We had to stand because the floor will get wet. All the while, chained by 1 foot.
That's how I spent 19 days. I thought, not even a dog would be treated like that.
The food was very bad. Just a lump of rice and beans served cold 3 times a day.
The worst was when you had to do your body's needs, and you had to do it in the open, in front of anybody who was around.
We were always shackled to each other. There were rainy nights with wet sheets. We could not sleep at all under those conditions.
The men were eventually delivered to Guantanamo Bay and quickly put on a plane to Florida. Only when they arrived on land, nearly 3 weeks after they were first detained, De Porto Carrero and Ramirez learned that they would be facing charges in the U.S.
I'm Cynthia Boyd. I'm a forensic neuropsychologist, and I practice in San Diego.
On a trip to California in April, I met with Dr. Cynthia Boyd. In the last 3 years, she's been asked by defense attorneys to evaluate the mental health of more than half a dozen men who were detained by the Coast Guard. She still can't shake the memory of the first detainee she spoke with in 2015.
Well, he was arrested for importing drugs. The mental illness that he then sustained was really from his capture, his arrest, and his subsequent incarceration.
This man, Winston Valdez, is from Ecuador. He gave Boyd permission to speak with us about his experience. His case did not involve Canadians, but closely echoed the experiences of detainees captured with Canadian involvement.
So Mr. Valdez and the other fishermen were taken aboard a Coast Guard vessel, and they were on board this vessel and various vessels for 27 days. They were held under inhumane conditions. I confirmed the conditions by the photographs that I received from the attorney. And these photographs showed ankle chains on the vessel's deck. He told me that there were several times when he thought he would die. He wondered if they would kill him aboard the ship. He's had several flashbacks of events on the ship. He made attempts to put on a brave face. But in my opinion, one cannot underestimate the emotional effects of this ordeal on him or the other detainees. He was subjected to circumstances that led to utter helplessness and a complete loss of personal control. Mr. Valdez and the other detainees sustained this trauma 24/7 for 27 days. I determined that Mr. Valdez suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Before Boyd started taking these cases, she worked as a contractor for the U.S. military. For 11 years, she evaluated soldiers returning from tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. She understood that because they were coming from battlefields, she had to anticipate trauma. But this was different. It took her by surprise.
I left the jail and I looked at the translator and I said, this is unbelievable to me. I've never been with anyone like this before. Mr. Valdez wasn't the perpetrator. He was arrested and he was detained. But the perpetrator was the Coast Guard. And I couldn't get my head around it because I love the military. And it was very, very hard for me to understand that service members would treat these detainees in this way, that there wasn't one human being on board in uniform that didn't have empathy.
I think there's almost a code of silence amongst the individuals who are doing this mission. And I think there's maybe a little bit of fear of retaliation from the commands about this, about speaking up. But I also feel that it's a blemish on our service.
Those are the words of a Coast Guard member with years of experience. He's been on a number of drug interdiction missions, and he spoke with us in April on the condition that we don't identify him.
To best protect his identity, we've had an actor read his exact words.
You know, I knew doing drug interdiction was always going to be a mission of the Coast Guard. I was under the impression when I joined that a drug interdiction case was an immediate transfer of the suspects to the shore for prosecution.
But that's not what he witnessed. The Coast Guard member confirmed the allegations that we heard from detainees about protracted detentions, scant rations, the shackles, and exposure to the elements.
You can get rain and sea spray at the exact same time if the weather's bad enough. It's awful. When we're out there, we are miserable. And we're out there for four-hour watches. So imagine being out there for days on end.
The Coast Guard member agreed to speak with us, despite the risk, because he says something needs to change.
The Coast Guard is an honorable service, and we have some of the best people that I've ever met in my entire life working in it, with good intentions to stop drugs from coming to the streets and to save lives. And I think that we're put in a compromising position due to government policy.
He told us that he dislikes having detainees on board, something that we've heard from other Coast Guard officials before.
We want these guys off the decks. We don't like seeing them in pain or hungry or hurting. You know, we want them to be prosecuted, but we also just want them to be treated like basic human beings. We really need to treat them within the confines of our law. They have a right to be seen in front of a federal magistrate in a quick amount of time, and I don't think 3 weeks is doing that.
We asked the Coast Guard to comment for this story. They did not respond.
But after my story in the New York Times Magazine, the head of the Coast Guard was quoted on the website military.com, saying that detainees are, quote, peddling poison. These aren't just down-on-their-luck fishermen. They have a choice. You can either fish or you can be a criminal.
He then added that the U.S. Coast Guard was considering leasing a commercial vessel to detain suspects, one that, quote, might have better accommodations than we have on ships with flight decks and helicopter hangars to at least get people out of the elements.
As best intentioned as the Coast Guard is, we are ill-equipped to hold detainees on deck for the amount of time that we're holding on to them. We don't have the space to properly hold them. I think that detainees aren't being given enough food to generally be comfortable for that prolonged amount of time. And I think that overall, being shackled for weeks on end is inhumane.
You're listening to a documentary produced in collaboration between CBC's The Current and the Investigative Fund in New York.
When we're tracking someone down and then everyone on the bridge has their night vision goggles out and their eyes are peeled, they're scanning the horizon, it's really intense.
Robin Lowe was deployed to the Pacific in 2016 aboard the HMCS Edmonton.
I am a Master Seaman Naval Communicator in the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve. My home unit is HMCS Unicorn in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
Lowe is 28 years old and has been in the Navy for nearly a decade. He says he's been part of interdictions in international waters.
It feels really kind of exhilarating because we're basically sneaking up on people.
Interdictions generally happen after nightfall, he says.
And all the upper deck lighting is off. We're basically invisible.
They wait, track the boat, and eventually pursue it.
Once we're close enough, we're allowed to like shine bright lights in their face so they can't really see anything, and all they see is this bright light coming from like 10 feet in the air.
Lowe is proud of Operation Carib, Canada's contribution to the American-led effort to stop drug trafficking. Operation Martillo.
It has a big impact on the operation as a whole. We are making like a big difference to what's on the streets in Canada and America even.
As far as you know, how are the detainees treated on the Coast Guard boats?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I've never seen it personally, so I can't tell. We wouldn't really see how they interact with the detainees. But I imagine they're very professional in what they do.
Robin Lowe may not have known about the conditions under which the Coast Guard was holding detainees when he was deployed in 2016. But senior-ranking members of the Canadian Armed Forces have known since at least the end of 2017.
We've learned that after my reports on detainee abuse appeared last November, senior military officials and the Canadian forces began communicating with each other about the allegations of mistreatment of detainees by the Coast Guard.
We've seen internal communications that show Canadian officials, up to the level of brigadier generals, were in touch about the article weeks after it was published. The communications mention an effort to look into the allegations, and a question is raised about whether the allegations would affect Canada's forthcoming participation in Operation Martillo. The communications also indicate that the Chief of the Defence Staff and Deputy Minister were aware of the allegations.
Months after these concerns were raised at the highest levels, the Canadian forces deployed again to assist the U.S. Coast Guard's drug patrols. Court records show that four suspected traffickers were picked up with the assistance of the Canadian forces during that deployment. They were held by the Coast Guard for 3 weeks before they were brought to a U.S. court.
In response to our questions, the Canadian forces sent us a statement. In it, they acknowledged they were aware of the allegations of mistreatment that had appeared in the New York Times and called them, quote, of grave concern to us. It continues, quote, although none of these claims pertain to Canada's participation in international anti-smuggling operations, we take those allegations extremely seriously.
The forces told us it quickly took several steps. Quote, we reviewed warship logbook entries, post-deployment reports, and significant incident reports for any indications of wrongdoing in relation to relevant Canadian Armed Forces operations. We conferred with our American counterparts and reconfirmed our respective roles and responsibilities and our expectations regarding the treatment of suspected drug smugglers.
Having taken these steps, we are confident that no Canadian Armed Forces members participating in Op Carib have witnessed or been involved in the mistreatment of suspected criminals, either on board Canadian vessels or those of our allies.
Since we began investigating this story, we've been trying to find out what rules and laws govern Canada's operations in support of the United States.
At the beginning of the year, we started filing access to information requests to the armed forces, asking for any and all agreements, memorandums of understanding, and directives about Operation Carib. Last week, we received notification that our request for these agreements was denied, pending consultation with the American government.
But in April, we spoke with a Canadian who did obtain some of these documents.
My name is Sarah Pelliquin, and I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I grew up there.
She moved to the United States to go to law school and has been practicing criminal defense for 11 years.
I'm a federal public defender in the Southern District of California in San Diego, so I represent individuals who are charged with federal criminal offenses who can't afford their own attorneys.
Her office has handled dozens of boat cases, some of them involving Canadian forces. As a Canadian, Sarah Pelliquin wanted to know what Seth and I wanted to know.
I had questions about whether or not the Canadian government and the U.S. Coast Guard were on the same page about the way that detainees would be treated, whether there was a consensus document or policy about what the treatment would be.
Sarah Pelliquin got back 88 pages from the Canadian forces in 2016. Which he shared with us.
Will you just read? So this is section S1.
Among the records is a directive issued by former Chief of the Defense Staff, Tom Lawson, about how the forces should conduct itself under Operation Carib.
The nature of the operation.
The 2015 directive is marked secret. It states that if Canadians ever detain someone, they shall, quote, act in strict compliance with Canada's domestic and international legal obligations.
So Section 2 says Canadian Armed Forces personnel.
And it outlines the rules under which a detainee can be transferred, saying, quote, detainees will not be transferred from Canadian Armed Forces care, custody, or control without the express permission of the Chief of the Defense Staff. And it goes on to lay out something called the transfer test. According to the documents,
any transfer
of detainees requires that the Chief of the Defense Staff
be satisfied that there are no substantial grounds for believing that there exists a real risk that the detainees would be in danger of being subjected to torture or other forms of mistreatment at the hands of the authorities to whom they are transferred.
Forms of mistreatment. The language in the directive is clear.
But the thing is, the Canadian forces assert that none of these suspected smugglers are actually detained by Canadians. In an email from February, a public affairs officer wrote to us, quote, the Canadian Armed Forces are not directly involved in law enforcement operations or the detention of vessels or persons. These detainees remain in the care, custody, and control of, and are guarded by, U.S. Coast Guard personnel.
We wanted to know what Canada's role looks like at sea. We asked for ride-alongs on both U.S. and Canadian ships. These were not arranged. Here's Naval Reservist Robin Lowe again.
Once we get close, then we send off our small boat with some of the law enforcement detachment on board.
He says during interdictions, the Canadians will launch a small patrol boat, which U.S. Coast Guard officials hop on before they approach a suspect smuggling boat. Lowe says there are typically 5 people on board.
There's one Canadian, they're bosun. They're the ones driving the boat. And then the other 4 are American Coast Guard law enforcement detachment that we have. So we switched the flag that's on the boat to, like on the small boat, to the American Coast Guard flag.
The Coast Guard is in control during the interdiction.
All that really happens from the Canadian side is we drive the boat to the suspect boat and provide a platform for the law enforcement detachment to hop off and take control of the situation. They're really the ones that have all the authority and they're able to run the show, basically.
Usually, suspects are left on board their trafficking boats until an American Coast Guard ship can arrive on scene to collect them.
Meanwhile, the boats are often tethered to a Canadian vessel and dragged.
The detainees are on the small boat, probably 4 hours at most. We give them water, food, like we don't let them just sit out there and burn.
If the weather is bad, or if there are concerns about the suspect's safety, the men may be brought aboard the Canadian ship. Lowe recalls one particular mission.
There was a point when there was a possibility that we were going to be bringing on detainees, but then the American ship was close enough to take them. But at that point, we were considering setting up cots, giving them access to a toilet, and providing a meal plan for them, making sure that they don't have any dietary restrictions or anything like that.
And though detainees were not brought on board in that case, we know it has happened.
So even though detainees may be sitting on the decks of Canadian ships and provided food and shelter, as far as the forces are concerned, they are not Canadian detainees.
The United States is violating international law, and Canada is doing so by complicity.
Michael Byers is a professor of international politics and international law at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He's been following Operation Carib since its inception back in 2006. Here's how he describes what happens to alleged smugglers.
There's a fiction here in that the suspects never actually cross into Canadian hands. That's the fiction. They're detained by a U.S. officer. They're arrested by a U.S. officer. And fictionally, they remain in the custody of the United States all the way through until and after their transfer to a U.S. vessel. But of course, this is all happening on Canadian sovereign territory. A Canadian naval vessel is an extension of Canadian territory onto the high seas, and that vessel can only be there because of the dozens or hundreds of Canadian forces personnel who are operating the ship.
He says there are a range of treaties that set out the prohibition on cruel or inhumane treatment of detainees, from the Torture Convention to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the allegations of mistreatment may mean Canada is party to violating those treaties.
Canada is providing a ship, a sovereign vessel, a Canadian Forces ship, with Canadian personnel on board who are responsible to the Canadian government and ultimately to Canadian citizens. And as part of that responsibility are bound by both Canadian and international law. If we figured out a way to use those equipment and personnel to facilitate a U.S. policy, and the United States is then violating international rules in using Canada ships and personnel, we're complicit in that illegality. You can't get around that.
Byers understands that the official position is that these maritime drug detainees are not in Canadian custody, but
we sign up to treaties in order to promote human rights, not to find loopholes. And I would put the question to the Canadian forces as to whether they want to be finding loopholes in laws that this country has led the creation of very proudly over the course of the last 70 years.
Canada is, for good reason, sensitive about the treatment of detainees. It played a role, one that some say the country has not fully reckoned with, in handing over Afghan suspects to authorities who later tortured the men. There have been numerous calls for an inquiry into the matter, but in 2016, Justin Trudeau's government decided one was not needed. However, last year, the International Criminal Court made a formal request to investigate potential war crimes in Afghanistan committed by local and international forces. And some advocates have urged the court to consider Canada's conduct.
Michael Byers is one of the people who has called for the ICC to investigate whether Canada was complicit in alleged torture in Afghanistan. And he believes there are parallels in this case. Now, nobody is saying the Coast Guard has tortured detainees, and no one is alleging war crimes. The war on drugs is not actually a war. But he says
the similarities are quite striking. First of all, this is a mission in which Canada is partnering with the United States, and the Canadian forces are very keen to partner with the United States. But the other clear parallel is the use of legal fictions to somehow excuse Canada's behavior. So in Afghanistan, the legal fiction was created that Canada would never formally detain people it came across on the field. If we came across someone who was suspect, we would pretend that we hadn't actually detained them until an American forces personnel or CIA agent came along and actually formally conducted the detention. So even though the person could not have been detained except for the presence of Canadian forces personnel, we fictionally didn't actually detain them and therefore fictionally didn't engage Canada's legal obligations. Again, that argument is specious. It's laughable. But that's the argument that's put forward.
Now, we know from those internal communications that Canadian brigadier generals raised a question. Would the allegations of detainee mistreatment on American vessels impact Canada's upcoming involvement in Operation Martillo?
When we first asked to speak with Canadian General Jonathan Vance, the forces instead set up an interview with the commander of the HMCS Whitehorse.
Good morning. This is Lieutenant Commander Colin Forsberg.
Hi, how are you?
The Whitehorse had just returned from an Operation Carib mission in the Eastern Pacific on May 3rd.
We got home yesterday afternoon.
We spoke to him on May 4th.
It was actually a very successful deployment for Whitehorse. We had two drug busts. Our first was a disruption of approximately 875 kilograms. And our second was a seizure of 1,500 kilograms of cocaine. So very good deployment for us.
There were also 20 suspected traffickers detained by the U.S. Coast Guard with the help of the Whitehorse, according to a report on the Canadian Forces website. Forsberg reiterated that it was the Coast Guard, not the Royal Canadian Navy, that had detained the suspects. And he told us he's proud of Canada's contribution to the American-led counter-narcotics mission.
And I feel it's a, you know, we have an excellent ongoing contribution to promote security within, you know, not only North America, but also South and Central America to counter the efforts of the transnational criminal organizations.
We asked Forsberg if he had heard about the alleged mistreatment of detainees held on Coast Guard vessels.
I have reported in the past on concerns about what happens to detainees after they're transferred to U.S. Coast Guard. Have you heard of those kinds of concerns, allegations that people are held for very, very long periods of time or shackled for weeks on end, exposed to the elements when they're on these boats? Are these allegations or things you've heard of that?
I've heard of that, but I've never seen that. And all I can say is that we, you know, with the memorandum of understanding that we have, except we stipulate that any personnel under U.S. Coast Guard custody will be treated in a manner that is respectful to their lawful rights and human dignity in accordance with their U.S. Coast Guard policy and international law.
So Commander Forsberg had heard of the allegations of mistreatment. We went back to the Canadian Armed Forces to ask again for an interview with Canada's top soldier, General Jonathan Vance.
It was after this second request that the forces sent us their statement, saying they found no indications of wrongdoing in relation to relevant Canadian Armed Forces operations.
It went on to say, quote, "That said, there is no doubt that this is a matter that we take very seriously. We must and we will remain vigilant. In particular, we will continue to review our operational practices and we will thoroughly investigate all credible allegations of Canadian Armed Forces involvement in mistreatment."
Canada will apply high standards, will meet its international legal obligations in those unusual circumstances where Canadian personnel actually end up conducting a detention on their own. But if the U.S. is detaining someone, these provisions don't apply and we look the other way.
UBC law professor Michael Byers says all of this raises deep questions about government accountability. And he takes aim at Canada's top command.
The leadership of the Canadian military is mandated to uphold the law. They are bound by both domestic and international law. And if the chief of the defense staff is knowingly allowing fundamental violations of human rights, he should be fired. Now, that's a really powerful thing to say, but these are really important rules, and they go right to the core of decades of Canadian foreign policy. And again, I have utmost respect for the abilities and the overall mandate and efforts of the Canadian forces. My message to General Vance is you can do better. Please do better. You have to do better.
They tie a rope from our boat to the stern of their Canadian boat, and they tow us for 2.5 days.
Dionico Garcia wrote from prison.
It started to rain very hard, and the waves were very large and dangerous.
He was detained in March 2017 by a Coast Guard team riding aboard a Royal Canadian Navy ship. Like many detainees, he says he's a fisherman from a village in Ecuador. He has 6 children, and he says he took the smuggling job because he was struggling to support his family.
The Royal Canadian Navy had succeeded in helping its ally stop Garcia's boat from hitting land, keeping its cargo, 660 kilos of cocaine, from reaching the streets.
After 2.5 days, the Canadians handed us to an American ship.
He was taken to Florida, where he was recently convicted and sentenced to 7 years in federal prison. Garcia finds it confounding that he was prosecuted in the United States, given that he was picked up so far from American territory. But mostly, he struggles to comprehend how he was treated on board the U.S. Coast Guard boats.
I remember that my 2 companions and I were very happy to be transferred to the U.S. Coast Guard. We had heard back in our country that the United States is the land of the free and the most respectful country in the world. But what we did not know was that we were about to live the most horrible experience of our lives.
We have been listening to The Catch. It was produced by The Current's Kristen Nelson and the Investigative Fund's Seth Fried Wessler, based in New York. As part of this collaboration, the editors on this project were Esther Kaplan from the Investigative Fund and The Current's documentary editor, Joan Weber. We'd like to thank the following Vancouver actors for their help voicing over the words of the following individuals. The views of the unnamed Coast Guard were voiced by Patrick Sabongi. The men convicted of drug smuggling all spoke or wrote to us in Spanish, so we asked the following actors to read the English translation. Gustavo Febres voiced Oscar Manuel Alvia's words. Rodolfo Funes spoke for Alfredo Herrera Villero. Stefan Chavaria did the same for Willington Ramirez. Omar Gallegos voiced Hubert Portocarrero Ruiz's words. And in Ottawa, David Villarreau repeated in English what we were told by Dionico Garcia. Let us know what you think of this report and the concerns over what Canadian officials knew. Tweet us at The Current CBC. Find us on Facebook. Go to our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent.